Hello, I'm Rachel Allen.
And I'm Jack Underwood.
And welcome to the Faber Poetry Podcast.
Hi, this is Courtney. And what you're hearing back here is a Mets game on TV. It's the top of the ninth inning. The Mets are up 5-2, and I'm watching it with my cat. I'm going to mute it now so that I can read this poem. The poem is called Last Night, Kyle. Last night, Kyle sang into the camera on his phone. I had a vision of getting into a truck with him late at night, harrowed because someone somewhere far away but close enough to drive was in the middle of dying and thought about hot girl summer. How I realized if I gave myself over to trying, I could predict the death of every person I loved, and I would have sworn I had no central delusion there on the street. Kevin Killian had just died. I thought, I'll stop and look into this churchyard. A stone angel leaned on a cross of different stone. Bothered by the sound of flowers smashing together in the breeze, I was overcome with some rosy-fingered feeling that poets are worth double or more, or the whole is different. This was the graveyard edit. No one said, hey, Courtney, that was pretty scary. Are you okay? Least of all myself. I went from door to door making non-profound confession. The yarrow stalks my witness. The water on the curtain of the carriage. You're supposed to find the person you could never be mean to. Bring them to meet your ancestors in the mausoleum. In the bathtub, I read about the ravine. In the ravine, I read about the bathtub. Never found the cool, both sides of the rock being hot. I was thinking of all the angels ever fallen. When the cards were a little hard to read, I got new ones. The spirit world rose toward me in everything, in the blue hat I saw on the platform, in the backwards song, garbage bags burned. I was always able to see the other life, but not this one. And in this one, the Marlins are down to their final strike. Coming to you from Brooklyn, New York. Let's hope he gets them.
That was an audio postcard from Courtney Bush. Her book, I Love Information, is coming out from Milkweed Editions in August 2023. Rachel, we're back here in the studio.
We're back for season three.
Yeah, well, the...
And it's going to be a musical podcast now.
Everything's going to be sung. What the hell's been going on, though? It's been so long. We had a pandemic. I don't know what else has happened. I mean, it seems it's such a sort of strange increment of time. It was blur. Yeah.
I think it has been 3 years since we recorded a podcast.
Oh, my goodness.
So it feels really, really special. Actually, very moving to be back talking to all these poets who have given us their time. And also to be able to be in person with them has been really nice. Yeah.
Yeah, I feel that. So, I mean, I did like that Instagram poetry thing in lockdown. And there was like a sort of furious activity around poetry in lockdown. I think people felt starved of the social aspects of poetry. Mm. But I kind of want to forget about all that now and get, and I don't know, it seems a relief.
Yeah.
You know, and also like coming out of lockdown, all that ever people talked about for the first sort of 6 months was lockdown. Mm. So we're not going to do that. We're going to like... jump right
we're
back.
We're marching forward.
Onto this.
Into the future.
On marching with just brand new Faber shoes on.
Mm-hmm.
Kicking some poems about.
Kicking some poets about.
Lifting up some rocks. Putting our bogeys on the fence posts to demarcate our progress. That's what we're going to do. I've had coffee, you can tell.
I've had three cups of tea. And who have we got in the studio today, Jack?
Today we have Nick Laird. Nick was born in County Tyrone in 1975. He is a poet, novelist, screenwriter, and former lawyer. His collections are To a Fault, On Purpose, Go Giants, and Feel Free. His novels are Utterly Monkey, Glover's Mistake, and Modern Gods. His awards include the Betty Trask Prize, the Geoffrey Faber Memorial Prize, a Somerset Maugham Award, the Aldbrough Poetry Prize, the Rooney Prize for Irish Literature, and a Guggenheim Fellowship. A fellow of the Royal Society of Literature, he is on faculty at New York at university and is the Seamus Heaney Professor for Poetry at Queen's University Belfast. His new collection, Up Late, is out in June, which is basically now. Hello, Nick. Welcome.
Hello.
And we also have Anthony Anaxagoru. Anthony is a British-born Cypriot poet, fiction writer, essayist, publisher, and poetry educator. His second collection, After the Formalities, which was published with Penned in the Margins, was shortlisted for the 2019 T.S. Eliot Prize. His third collection, Heritage Aesthetics, was published by Granta Books and was the 2023 winner of the Ondaatje Prize. Thank you.
Welcome,
guys.
Anthony.
Thanks very much. Lovely to be here. It's freezing.
It is cold in here. A little fridge.
I prefer that because I flush like a little schoolboy.
I run hot, actually.
Do you?
Yeah.
I just look like Just William.
Do you guys run hot or cold?
I'm always cold, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Anthony?
I don't know. Not too sure.
Welcome both. Well, we're running on hot, so that's fine. Let's start off with some poems. That's what we normally do.
Yeah, yeah.
Nick, could we hear something from you?
Sure. Short or long?
Longish.
Yeah. Okay, so it's like a page and a half.
Unless you don't mind taking requests.
I could do requests.
My favourite, maybe. I mean, you don't have to have favourites in a book, but I really liked American Poem.
Oh, well, that's short.
I
see what you're doing there, Jack.
But I like, there's a particular phrase which I've used a couple of times in conversation and then immediately felt guilty about passing off as my own.
Maybe you could read American Poem and another.
Yeah, let's do that.
So this was an American poem. I wrote it for an Extinction Rebellion day. So very hard to write a kind of like poem about climate, but this is, I suppose, as close as I could get. American Poem. I also hope to visit tropical resorts to feel the texture of expensive sadness. I wanted to avoid slaughter by growing so large I would not fit in the machine. But thinking everything was magic was the same as thinking nothing was. Magnets, racecraft, three-card Monty. I know nothing of your grief, granted, nor you mine, but isn't that why we're here? No philosopher ever went into the deli on Mercer and Spring and asked Mohammed just to make her whatever sandwich the universe had preordained. For once we might exalt the significance of facts and information. I hope to stop reliving things I said once that were mildly funny, and also stop being forced to organize the populace in boxes, imagined boxes, and heaping up these pyramids of objects I do not need or love, and extracting rotted bodies from the earth, a liquid dead we latch and suckle hard upon until the shrieking halts, until we grow engorged as ticks, as cysts, and burst.
Can we hear, let's have another one.
I was going to do Attention, the poem was just published this week, which is about, I'll do this one, it's shorter. I don't know if you've ever seen a magpie kill a baby rabbit, but I have. The outing. The magpie reasserts its stance with a testy flap of black on white, a flash of blue. And a stone might do, but doesn't, so I have to shoo it off with a folded tartan picnic blanket. And the baby rabbit, what is left of it, keeps screaming. And it happens that your options narrow, sometimes drastically, and what you might do if the kids were not here is walk to the car and get in it and leave, turning up the radio. But they want to know, now, what one does with enormous pain when you see it, where you should put it, how might you stop it, and they're watching, and the rabbit is done, past saving. So I lift the stone again and the bird hops off as I walk across and looks on with interest. And if at first I miss it, the second time smashes in the socket of the rabbit's eye, the one the magpies emptied out already to a plush red nest, a divot of flesh. I'm in the driver's seat and breathing and need to drink some water. I can overhear it screaming in the silence that fills the car on the drive back to a house that is a little different, harder, sharper, and where my children will not look at me.
Thank you so much. That poem's really powerful to hear read out loud.
I think you sent it to me recently to read.
Yeah, was it in the New Yorker?
Yeah, recently? different title. It was called Sorrow. Yeah.
Why did you change the title?
I quite like the idea of the outing being a kind of double-edged word, meaning both a day out and a kind of being outed as a kind of violent psychopath in front of your kids. It seemed to do double work. And the word sorrow was maybe a little bit plain and had that echo of One for Sorrow from Magpie. It was, I don't know, I suddenly went off it.
That's a really interesting and quite complicated layering, though, of like a presentation of personhood in this poem, because it's obviously not being like a psychopath to put an animal out of its misery,
sure.
But it's this introduction of like death and pain and necessary pain, I suppose, to children, and this sort of like movement from innocence to experience, but written in this beautiful kind of like measured way that like heaps shame, I think, on the person doing the kind of movement or moving the children from innocence to experience.
Yeah.
Which is so, I don't know, it feels like it's luxuriated in almost, in a kind of like quite, I don't say like, it's not sinister, but it's like definitely somber and like elegiac, I suppose, but towards ecological states. Yeah.
I think there's something about killing an animal, though, that does, you have to steel yourself to the task. You do have to sort of inhabit a slightly kind of a coldness, and you do are sort of standing on the edge of something. I remember putting a pigeon out of its misery because my parents' cat had caught it, and I was insisting on that it was my dad. It was my parents' cat. I was like, Dad, are you going to just let the cat like toy with this? The thing was, it was awful. It was on the gravel, and I put a flower pot over its head, thinking if I just stamp on the flower pot, that will break its neck. But all that I did was smash the and then I did have to do a proper job, and I went off and got a spade. But like but there is the moment when the sort of the spade is raised, and you're sitting there, and you have to think, you don't want to do it, and you have to kind of will, and it's surprising to find yourself kind of go to the all or nothing front of it, and think like, if I don't do a good job of this, I'm prolonging it. So you got to fully commit, and that full commitment to putting the animal down is. It's difficult and dark and I've dispatched a few poor creatures growing up in the countryside, and I thought this poem sort of got to the sort of sickly, oily center of that moment, really. Although obviously it feels also like you say, Rachel, that there's an analogy there, or that there's a symbolic that moment of the spade being raised.
Because this is quite obvious realization, isn't it? And like behind it, there's so much more like domestic kind of play or like sinisterness sort of moving around. And I think I'm always interested in your poems and their kind of like how they inhabit this incredible lyric address. And I feel like there's such an enjoyment of a kind of lyric mode that seems to sort of create a musicality out of really ragged, like difficult kind of subject matter. And I think the lyricism that you inhabit allows that ragged, jagged subject matter to be like, I don't know, whirlpooled around in a way that feels like very, I suppose like musical. It's like looking at a really like difficult but brilliantly done like painting or something that makes you feel incredibly moved, but you know that there's something just like off with it, like off kilter maybe. It's like a lyricism but like tipped upside down, and I'm kind of interested in the way that you approach form with the kind of things that you write about. And you know, you and I worked together on the poem that is sort of the core of this book, I suppose, Up Late, which is about the death of your father. And, you know, I was thinking the same kind of thing, these incredibly, like, moving, corrosive, hard, raw feelings that you, like, manage or negotiate into this mode that on the surface feels neat, but actually isn't.
Yeah, I mean, okay, yeah. I mean, I agree with everything you said. I think part of the thing is negotiate is the word that's used in Up Lit as well. You're trying to put feelings into words and trying to put something into shape. You're trying to scrape some kind of pattern out of circumstance. So that seems to me what the work of the poem is in some way. And it's, you know, this poetry and philosophy maybe come towards the same thing, this trying to scrape meaning out of circumstance. And one of the ways you do that is shape, or, you know, in poetry, and you begin with particulars and kind of work up. So it's pushing at some questions about patterning and about life. And I need to kind of do that. I think I want to have shape in poems. I'm sort of interested in, it allows you to have something feel inevitable if it has a shape. And at the same point, you can get to be surprising. Mm. And I want, when I encounter a poem, I want it to be surprising and inevitable at the same time. And that's why shape is sort of useful to me, or form, or whatever you want to call it, or pattern.
Yeah, I love that. I've never really thought about, like, the kind of pattern of the lyric as having an inevitability that we can sort of play with or take comfort in or even fear or disrupt, because we know we're working in a state that, like, imposes a certain way of talking to or talking from, and we know we're going to end up somewhere, and to play with that. Yeah, you really do that in your poems, actually. And I love that patterning idea as well.
The way that sort of things like that pressurization, that certain expectations, or when you have an eye and an event or a feeling, and you're kind of having to work into it. Eventually, you've got to get somewhere. And the further you get into the poem, the closer you are to having to end it or come up with something, right? So yeah. You're kind of, this kind of burrowing.
Mm. How did the book come together? Is it a sort of...
You know, like all books, sort of slowly and painfully, and you reach a certain stage and think, that must be enough poems now for a collection. 5 years since the last one, so... but the long poem at the heart of it, the Up Late one, was written, as you know, sort of very quickly after my father had died. So, and then it seemed that a lot of the poems were kind of moving around in some way. These, some of the similar things. There's a lot of elegies in the book, people dying. There's stuff about, you know, a kind of end of a certain system. You know, stuff about late capitalism and those kind of thoughts. A collapsing systems change, so it seemed like it was the long poem Up Late when it came along kind of crystallized a lot of the previous stuff, and I could see a shape to the thing, which maybe I hadn't been there before.
I want to talk further about how we approach the kind of contemporary moment in your poems, but it's probably a good time, talking of the contemporary moment, to loop in our other guest, Anthony.
Mm-hmm.
Would you like to read us a poem or two poems?
Yeah, but is there requests?
Oh!
I know. I really know where to start with this thing.
Mother Myth.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard for me to choose, really.
It's interesting about that whole, like, poems going towards something, because I think with this one, so much of the poems are, like, orbital and just, like, circumambulating, like, an idea without that creating causality, but also... Mm. But not leading anywhere, like that kind of inevitability of just having things circle in the way that an emotion circles, like when we spiral, when we get into our heads, we don't land anywhere. We just kind of go round and round and round.
But I suppose with the orbiting, what that the process of orbiting does lead to is the sort of demarcation of the center, even if that center is kind of absent or invisible at the end of it.
Mm.
And I think, like, that's definitely that, you know, you can go round and round in cycles of kind of self-loathing or like fear, joy, fear, like grief, hope, and you can keep kind of digging away.
Yeah.
But I think
maybe like what, and that's obviously never ending, but to do that and to, yeah, you're in doing that, you're actually, you're suggesting something else. You're suggesting the kind of reason why. Yeah. I think one of the things I love about your poems through that kind of orbiting and that digging around in language is that maybe what comes through the most is a kind of certain frustration or a desperation or a need to find the words, even if the poems themselves kind of also have a slightly sort of resonant dissatisfaction.
Yeah.
If not with, maybe with themselves, I don't know.
Yeah. There's a restlessness there for sure that can't keep still, which I'm really, at first you're kind of always taught, I think in writing, to kind of linger on an idea, whereas you're not really taught to dart and move. But in poetry, you can, that choreography, you're allowed to jump around as much as you want. I think reading...
Associative logic.
Yeah,
I think
exactly.
That's what you have.
Yeah, and I'm massively into symbol. Like, I think you can, symbolically, semiotics, like, you can definitely be... I feel symbols are safer than realism, which is sometimes when I read a poem that's entrenched in, like, realism, I feel really uncomfortable, whereas symbolism, I really enjoy it. Like, I feel I can do what I want. I just feel I've got more autonomy in those kind of more expansive, stranger, odd things.
There's more like artifice in realism, isn't there? Because you've got to kind of rig up something.
Yeah.
The version of events, you know, it's almost like a witness statement.
Yeah.
You're committing to a version of reality which you're saying was what happened. Whereas with symbolism, you're kind of working into a sense of like what happened, but...
There can be a performance of artifice, though, I suppose, can't there? In, like, things that are purportedly real. Like, I was thinking about the Veronica Forrest Thompson bad naturalization, good naturalization, like, whether something is trying to communicate a certain kind of authenticity and which modes are usually used in poetry to communicate authenticity. And I don't know if we're in a space now where it's, like, everything is always going to be aware of its artifice, even if it's, like... directly a communicative poem, right?
Well, there's that term authenticrat, which I think Joe Kennedy came up with, which is this idea, you know, all the politicians who are sort of, who always keep their eye on how much the price of a pint of milk is, and like a very like vocally support a football team and kind of like, I'm a man, the kind of man of the people routine that you can see, and like that this kind of like, that's what the myth of what ordinary people, real people.
Like, we're always going to be aware of the frame now in which we're working. I don't think there's a way, maybe there was never a way to not be aware of the frame.
Well, self-consciousness, yeah. Let's hear a poem. Let's rescue us from our own self-consciousness.
This is called Futurist Primer. Last night they broke into the confidence shop, leaving nothing but mirrors. The whole time I was awake trying to fix my router. Today I'm sipping Americanos with six new interns, pontificating on the stoicism of lifeguards who grew up in rural England with all the prospects of a stationary outlet. In a few hours, a man will walk down the street in Birmingham to drive a knife into a person he's never heard laugh. Violence only teaches us how to keep returning to it. In real life, we share a third of our DNA with mushrooms. Some facts need to be written down before they're believed. My landlord spends his holiday on a Cumbrian field with his wife, who coincidentally happens to be my brother's landlord. There, they hold each other inside a small blue tent after weeks of heavy rain. I imagine them laying over some part of 100 million insects, which constitute the majority of the world's biomass. How their gorgeous, slow lovemaking might sound to a swarm of abstaining termites, a single ant roving the near underworld with nothing but a crumb of honest soil. I think about the cost of living and how for now we're alive enough to fuck on top of the earth, our bodies fecund with unripe disease. In 40 years, my son will be updating his CV for a job that doesn't exist yet. I'll be sat like a bookmark at the kitchen table, stirring tea in an easy way, thinking about my mother and father and the day's water was water. A soft-voiced lady with perfect posture will project onto the wall of my living room via a device fixed to the roof,
booth, hoping to sell me a brighter version of myself, saying something like, "We'll keep the future in your size." I'll decline, returning to the sofa, where I'll remember the greengrocer, the joys of his old Instagram account, full of organic kale and deals on kombucha. Then before I do anything else, I'll think, the penis really does not age well.
Thank you. I honestly never thought a poem about landlords fucking would be one of my fave poems of all time, but here we are.
Mm. 2023, man.
I really like that poem. I love it. It's funny because it feels like it kind of encompasses so much of what's going on in the collection. It also feels like one of the more kind of like it's like a space where there's like comedy in the book as well, but then there is actually quite a bit of like dark comedy, I think, weaving throughout. But one of the things that I love that you do in that poem, which I feel like is not a rarity, but I just think something that could be done more and is done in a really special way in that poem, is like involve genre in this really like easy, interesting, special way. Like it becomes a sci-fi poem, or it is a kind of sci-fi poem.
Yeah, dystopian sci-fi. Yeah.
And I love how, you know, I find using like the frameworks of fiction really helpful in poetry. And I also think that that's something that you do in your work outside of any kind of playing with genre. Like there's so many mini fictions and mini narratives that run through the book. And this associative logic that we were talking about is also like storied. Like you leap between places and people and characters and families in a way that feels like really global, like a kind of like critique of the global, but also like an understanding of the global and the failure of globalization. And this is more of a comment, not a question.
These are great comments, man. Yeah, I'll stick all this down somewhere.
But maybe you could talk about like, I don't know, genre or using fiction or using story in the poems.
I think I like cinema. I like finding the cinema of a poem, like its kind of filmic element, and then not resolving. So opening all these little frames and then kind of just letting my kind of instinct and impulse take me to the next frame without thinking what logically would follow that. And I think working off impulse and instinct was a huge kind of part of this book. Because that's when I think you're the freest and your subconscious is kind of just at its most active. And I just trust the channel that all of these little frames are coming from, because I think they all come from the same place. And that's really it, you know. And I think when you get into a sound, when the poem develops its own voice, its own personality, and I kind of think of poems as little units of personality that are like psychology under pressure. And I think putting a personality with its psychology into one room is how you kind of have poems come about. So, yeah, I think that was it. But they are like little characters, little people, worlds within worlds, because I think that's what we live in, isn't it?
Like,
yeah,
it's like the filmic without necessarily the kind of narrative that we associate with filmic.
Or the episodic, because I think so many films are based around frames and episodes, you know, like...
You know how, like, when you've watched a film and when you're thinking back to it, it's strange what kind of sticks out, and that's a bit like kind of poems. Like that long poem, Henniker's Ditch, which we've probably talked about on the podcast a few times, that it's like the bits of the film that you remember, you know, and it's kind of confusing. It's like when you watch, you know, The Fifth Element?
Yeah.
The only thing I can really remember from that film, or the first thing I can remember, is the cigarette with a really long filter.
Didn't a woman have three boobies in that film?
No, that's Total Recall.
Oh.
This is like, you know, the cigarette where the proportion of the cigarette that would be cigarette now is reversed. So it's like this tiny little cigarette on the end of a really long filter.
It's a cigarette holder, isn't it?
This is like Bruce Willis, who's got like, he goes to smoke a cigarette and it tells him how many he's had, I think, this little robot. And when he takes out the cigarette, it's like mainly filter. And the tiny little nub of actual cigarette on the end.
That's so stressful.
Mm. Yeah. But this is what I mean, like the little flashes of like the three boobies, whatever.
It's how your memory places itself within like the bigger landscape of what happened. Mm. Like, you know, like how memory chooses to kind of isolate certain things. And I think that's what a lot of the time I like thinking about. Why do I remember that The whole day happened, and I remember three things.
Yeah, I watched the whole film, and what my brain takes away from that is this, Well,
Freud would have something interesting to say about your memory of the three boobs and your memory of the phallic cigarette.
Yeah, the little tiny little cigarette.
Cigarette, yeah. Can't believe I said boobies on the podcast.
Yeah. Well, there we go.
It's the scan, like the way I think about, because I feel that films and poetry are really close, and it's the kind of scanning of a landscape. And I think because you do so much world building in your collection, alternative worlds, worlds that we recognize, like worlds that we don't recognize, whatever, worlds that you recognize or not, it's as though you're just like scanning a camera, I suppose. And that idea of like fulfilling the frame, or like fulfilling the frame, is really interesting, because there's still like accidental debris that comes in when that happens in a film. And I feel like that's the same for your poetry. Like, you allow this kind of like debris to remain, like it within the sort of frame of the still.
Yeah. I think it's trying to have like identify a central organizing principle that is for me quite abstract and private, and have everything point towards that. And that's really how you build them. Otherwise, end up just becoming too baggy, and everything's just, it just feels like a nonsense, like a bit of a word salad. And so the idea is to try and find something very specific, usually like an abstract feeling, and have everything work, or like push everything, all the image work towards that. And that's how you keep, that's how I keep it together. Otherwise, it just goes all over the place.
I think about like somebody like Maymay Bersenbrugger, who I've talked about on the podcast before, definitely. I was like revisiting her A Treatise on Stars, which is like a book-length poem, basically, on like the cosmos. And the way that she just like bounces between herself and the stars is so like elemental and filmic and focused, and like there's the observation, I suppose, which I think, yeah, links all poets, but you both sort of approach observation in really different ways.
Yeah.
So we have ascertained in the run-up prior to the recording of this interview that neither of our poets have talismans with them. But Nick has at least sort of got a dog ate my homework shortlist of potential talismans. Here's what you could have won.
Also, maybe the lack of talisman is like talismanic.
Oh, well, right? we've done that before.
Have we?
I think we've come to that conclusion that the absence of a talisman is
the talisman itself.
The talisman of talisman. What have you got written down then, Nick?
So I was sitting at my desk this morning, and Hannah said about bringing a talisman, and I was looking around the desk, and I don't have anything like that. The only talisman I have is my laptop, which I carry everywhere with me, and I don't have a smartphone or whatever, so I need my laptop to do everything, including write on. But I have my radio, which I normally have night tracks playing from Radio 3, the podcast. I had a little, a wee tea heater. You put a tea light in and you can put your cup of tea on it and it keeps it warm. And then my dictionaries, my dog is usually there at my feet. I couldn't bring my dog in. And there's a peanut feeder outside the window of my shed.
Oh, yeah.
That's all I had.
That's lovely.
That's for like birds and squirrels and stuff.
Yeah, birds, yeah.
Yeah, for a second there, I thought I imagined a sort of gumball machine.
I thought that first.
Did you? That'd be amazing.
I was like, wow.
And I've got
that.
A stack of quarters when I just
put them in. Bad for your cholesterol, good for your protein. okay.
That's a very sweet list.
That is. I mean, and also, like, world building. I can see that room. That's nice, isn't it?
And, I'm interested that you don't have a smartphone.
I never had one.
Wow.
But the laptop, I mean, that the way that the sort of like that centralizes the laptop as the sort of the portal.
Yeah, you can't get Ubers though, and you can't learn how to get anywhere, so I still carry around my A to Z.
Oh, that's a nice, can we see the A to Z? I haven't seen one of them in a while. Like
they've stopped making them, you know.
Yeah, I know, I heard that. They are a sort of sacred object now. Yeah. I definitely remember like on a day like this, very rainy day. Trying to find the street that you want to get to, and then the a bus stop or something.
Yeah,
that was part of the fun.
Yeah, do you find it fun still?
I don't. It's a nightmare. You can't park anywhere. You can't find anything.
They are very handy though, and small and nice.
They're nice, but they take what is now a 15-second Google into a sort of 10-minute like rooting around. Yeah, you feel like you should
yeah. I stop.
You should win like a little badge that you can
sew. I use my A to Z.
Yeah, you need your A to Z badge, yeah. Tea, that's interesting. You mentioned you've got a tea warm. I'm concerned that that might just damage your cup, though. How far away from the cup is it elevated?
I haven't made it myself. It's a you know, it's made to do it. It's like a wee metal shelf thing, and then you put a candle underneath it and it keeps your tea warm.
Like a fondue.
Yeah, kind of.
That's better than bunging it in the microwave, isn't it? That's what my nan used to do.
Really?
Rancid.
It's got a thermos. Sometimes I use the thermos.
Yeah, hot liquids. That's good.
I know someone in this room who may have a tea interest.
Tea fetish?
Maybe. I would like to choose tea, like your tea set up as your talisman.
Actually, yeah, that's true. I mean, I always have, when I'm deep in it, I do have the little Gai Wan and a Gongdao Bei just sitting to the right, always to the right. Hmm. And then I sip away on the good tea.
You have a ceremony, though.
Well, it's not really a ceremony. It's just a mode of brewing called Gong Fu that originated in 16th century China. But yeah, it's just a method of brewing loose leaf tea.
Hmm.
So that's what I can kind of start going off on one, but that becomes a tea podcast.
That's what this is.
No. You don't want the tea podcast.
Spilling the tea. Yeah, I mean, it would be, I think if we had a our own like YouTube channel, we would definitely get some, we would definitely some niche, do brewing some
niche tea.
You actually recommended me some.
Yeah, I know, yeah.
Yeah.
We still haven't had the session. That's still on the
Well, pendant. You should have bought it in today.
But the thing is, like, I feel like you're quite into... What was that drink you had?
Matcha. Oh, spirulina.
Sure. What are these? I just don't know what you're talking about.
I have
about.
A bit of a Gwyneth Paltrow side to me that is best left in her cage. Yeah.
So you might keep your whatever matcha Greens. Warm with a vagina-smelling
I mean, candle. Matcha's kind of mainstream now, right?
Is it?
Yeah.
Do you know what matcha is? He's a man of the world, you see.
It's bubble tea, like
I
Gen
feel
Z's
like Jesse's diets from the Far Show this week, where I've been like the sort of man who appears with his sack trousers filled up with twine sometimes. I haven't heard of any of these things, but I still drink just like black coffee, whatever's going.
That's classier, I think. I just can't. Anyway, enough about my beverage intake. We should have another poem from both of you.
Yes.
Love those talismans, though. We got there in the end.
We
just had to dredge them out of you.
They're so close to you. They're not talismans because they're so...
They're not realisable.
Yeah. Because they're so part of your everyday kind of like makeup.
Yeah. Mm.
Would you like to kick us off with a poem?
Yeah. I'll do Endgame. I mean, I just opened it here, so let's do Endgame. At the close of capitalism, catch the professor and I waving our big flags at the parade. Our haircuts inspired by Bart's coinage, gusts of life. Seniors leaning out of windows, their imminent deaths a thing of the past. That's me in the corner, suffering conclusions. That's me itching to sing my killers to sleep, leaving them supine in a retro spa. All together now, as if we were smuggling winter into Dartmoor, as if this were a collective effort to find the oath I buried inside a chapel organ. The professor read how my mother thought to smother the hour I was born in. You're right, I'm reaching beyond the pablum for a straw man to leave my plasma. On, muscled colonies so saccharine I could die. All together now, as if we were the study of a pale body tanning in unison. It's not life we want more of, it's beauty. These days you can watch the world soften in high definition. Watch a man fire into a crowd until the man becomes a government. My grandmother dug up the last of her savings, then went on to fill her purse. The cicadas are screaming to know why their singular music moves me to the point of vapour. The professor believes the future is undergoing its final autopsy. Isn't that why the highest grossing movies always contain some kind of high speed chase, and why most conversations between strangers begin with the mention of weather, which in itself is a kind of light.
Lovely.
Thank you.
Nick, could we hear another from
Sure.
Up Late?
This is a poem in memory of my friend Martino who died. Attention is a single white marble, translucent with a turquoise wave breaking within it. Attention, is that marble bouncing wildly down the alley and reaching the top of the steps by the bar I met you at in Monte, Martino, to sit out the evenings drinking on those steps, where all the treads are bowed in the middle by millennia of pilgrims heading up to San Pietro in Vincoli to seek forgiveness, to bow their heads, to ask some questions of themselves in a place. Attention is a single block of white Carrara marble carved by Michelangelo into the statue of Moses we stood before, stoned, wondering why he'd horns. And attention to the style of things is an attribute worn, Martino, by you around Hoxton or Testaccio like a purple boiler suit, which you also wore. And attention is that single white marble now descending the stone steps by the bar, rolling along the depth of one tread and dropping, then rolling the depth of another and dropping, and the next, dropping and rolling, not silently, until the single white marble, translucent with a turquoise wave, hits the pavement and skitters onto the cobbles to wedge, pearl-like, beneath the tire of a Vespa. Martino, it is evening and raining in London, and I am making tea, and we don't say that we both know it is the last time we will meet. Your face is swollen from the treatment, and your head fantastically stitched together as you sit on the edge of the sofa, all attention, all wrapped in chains of attention. Evincoli can be translated as constraints, bonds, ties, links, or limits, obligations. The chains of St. Peter, the rock of the church, sit in a mother-of-pearl box Freud walked past to stand before the Moses statue. He writes his seated, his body faces forward. His head with its mighty beard looks to the left. His right foot rests on the ground, and his left leg is raised so that only the toes touch the ground. What the statue says to me is that Moses can barely stop himself, that he almost cannot bear it, is on the verge of rising and allowing something overwhelming. Rage, I think, free rein. And impatiently he stares down tourists traipsing past, outfacing them as he had outfaced Freud, who came every afternoon for weeks to try to disentangle the piece's emotional effect. Attention from the Latin ad tendere, to stretch toward, to try to meet. And Tino, in your brain, the tumour spread so fast it had taken the shape in the scan of a finch in flight, and has pegged away your mind to such an extent you can write still but not read. And as you sit in the kitchen attending, attending, all bound up in these chains of attention, all charged with a terrible, helpless attention, I want to tell you Michelangelo is reputed to have loved the statue so much he hurled his hammer at it and cried that it would not speak.
Stunning. Thank you.
Amazing.
It's like those things you're talking about, though. Like, you don't know what the poem is about until you've read it, and then you go back to it afterwards, and then you start to realize why that image at the end, like, why the statue that doesn't speak, and you realize the poem, which I'm just realizing now, is about the limitations of art, that you cannot bring the dead back, you can't make the dead speak.
Hmm.
Sort of interest in that, and you just have no idea what the poems are about half the time until you return to them later on.
I had a mate of mine once who sent me a message. I think it was in a Frank O'Hara poem, and it towards the end, and she just said that she read the line, and it was something like, and then the sun set, and she was just in bits, like she was crying, she couldn't contain herself, and she was like, I don't get why that last line, that's actually very prosaic and very straightforward, messed me up so much. And I said, it's not the line, it's everything that came before.
Yeah, the accumulation to that moment.
The pressure that builds. And I think it's the same, you know, like when you get quite straight, which is this whole thing of, do we have to make poems these huge climactic endings? Or can they just turn the volume down on?
But that, the sunset is such a, I mean, that's one of the deep images that underpin all of, you know, literature. Like, you think of Vespers, wherever we would go and say the evening prayers, you think of heading westwards as the deep metaphor for everyone going towards their death. It's like very hard to get away from that in all of literature. Think of John Donne's poem Good Friday, you know, riding westward, and it's always about heading towards where the sun has set.
I was thinking about the Elizabeth Bishop, the North Haven, the Barrows cannot change their song, dear friend. The poem that she wrote for Lowell. We can rearrange. I didn't know if you were thinking about that at the end of that poem, but it felt like, yeah, the sort of bird imagery is incredible there. Absolutely amazing. Yeah, no, I'm just such a bird.
Oh, shit, yeah.
It's really amazing.
Oh, it was hit, man. Did you get some tissues or something in here?
I have tissues in my massive
body. Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah. We can just cut this bit out.
No, keep it rolling. It's gold.
It's really amazing. I've got some. Fucking hell.
Yeah.
That's just really, really, really amazing. I'm just sad. Thank you.
Yeah, it's those poems that build worlds, isn't it? Like, when you get in them. I think that's what I kind of like about longer poems, is you've got that time to build up. Whereas short poems just kind of feel like a quick chat and then you're gone. Whereas the long ones is so much... Even, I think that's always spoken word. You know, when I remember spoken word days, it was you had 5 minutes on a poem and audiences could really, like, get into the... It was felt a lot more like three-dimensional. And when I've written longer poems versus shorter poems, you always get that. You feel there's something to invest in. Whereas a short poem, I don't know if you can invest in quite the same way.
But then when a short poem is done well, it's like, whoa.
Yeah, it really...
Yeah, you have to talk in the kind of, in the room, you know, in what you leave out, don't you? But the long poem, you get to sort of gather more into play.
Yeah.
I think about like a poem like Creeley's I Know a Man. Have we talked about
my
it already?
God, yeah.
Yeah. That
yeah.
And that I said to my friend John.
Yeah.
Let's just get a big ass car and
drive.
Yeah. And he's just like, although that was not his name, that's the my favourite part about that.
That was not his name.
Yeah.
For God's sake.
Just shut up and
let's
drive.
Just, yeah, there's so much chat.
And why don't we buy a goddamn big automobile?
We're really collaborating on totally bastardizing this poem. but one of my, like, some of my favourite poems of all time are, like, tiny five lines, you know.
I think it's a different kind of...
investment.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
It's what it wants. It's what the contract it makes with the reader, I think, is really, in, you know.
It takes quite a lot of sort of like, you're almost having a bit of a laugh when you write a really short poem.
Oh yeah, I was going to say it has to play with itself.
Well, I think we'd like to say that it was a sensuous overflow of poetic connection. But, no, but it could also be several wines.
No, that poem, I'm a Pisces also, but that poem is absolutely incredible. Yeah. But yeah, I like this idea of like, the way that you invest or relate to or like receive a poem.
What's your shortest poem?
Mine?
Yeah. How many lines?
Couplet.
You've
got a couplet?
I'm saying Rachel probably.
I was trying to find that Michael L. Craig poem, which is my favourite poem of all time, probably about tomato. It's called Tomatoes Disrespect Us. Do you remember that? And it's absolutely ridiculous, but I don't think I'm going to be able to find
Charles Simic has that poem Evening Chess, which is something like... the white king raised in my father's angry hand or something
that's
like that.
Nice.
Or maybe the black queen. Maybe it's the black queen.
This one by Salima Hill I love. It's called No One.
Muldoon has some nice, really short poems. Yeah. There's that, is it called Snow? It's either called Snow or White. And it's my mother showed me a photograph of you got up in lace, white crepe de chine, white bonnet, white mittens. Once on a street in Moscow, a woman shoved snow into my face when it seemed I was frostbitten. That's paraphrased.
Oh, Jack, that's amazing.
The short Muldoon one I love is Ireland. Do you know that one?
No.
Volkswagen parked in the gap, gently ticking over. Yeah. You wonder if it's lovers and not men hurrying back across two fields and a river.
Yeah.
Oh, you guys have really... got it.
I don't know. I can do some Tupac lyrics.
I mean, that poem is like, you have to read, you're reading so much into that last, it's incredible, yeah, that
it's
last
like the
image.
Last 30 years in Northern Ireland.
Yeah. That is extraordinary. I think also it's interesting that That's not. Does that one rhyme? No.
Yeah.
Yes, it does. Yeah.
River lovers.
Yeah, yeah.
Helps to embed it.
There's something about like the connectivity, which it says like this plus this plus this.
That's what I mean about playing with
memorability. Itself. You know, it's so much easier to remember a poem that rhymes.
Mm.
The circular. That's the circular.
And if it's short,
as well.
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah. This is the ancient mariner, which I have my heart. Yeah.
Thank you both. So much for coming in today and sharing your incredible work with us. It's been an honour to chat to you guys.
Thank you. There's some, the difficulty is where to start and where to stop with such rich collections and such like enigmatic turns and how much you kind of get into your poems and allow us to get out of them. So I feel like, we could have another hour and another podcast and come out with completely different results. Yeah.
There's so much more I actually wanted to ask you guys about, like history and characters and everything else, but we'll leave it here.
Yep, we must. We can't keep them. Somebody, you can unlock the door now.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hello, I'm Emily Berry and I'm going to be reading a poem from my book, Unexhausted Time, which is a sort of book-length poem made up of individual poems, some of which have titles, some of which don't. This one doesn't. And the poem includes some borrowed lines from the film Le Jeté, directed by Chris Marker, and from the letters of Sigmund Freud. This is the story of a man marked by an image from childhood. Of a truth too fantastic to be believed, he retains the essential, an unreachable country, a long way to go. There is something shocking about a family, the way they gather together, all looking the same, the way they don't gather together. At the back of the house, the lawn stretched out like a sheet, as if flung by the rockery. There was a shed in which children conducted business. There was a room with a frilled counterpane. As a child, I compiled lists of names on long train journeys. Adelaide, Alice, Aileen. Why do you think I did that? Some letters carried a sorrow they couldn't shake off, like N, such a sad letter. Always in the shadow of M. I don't know why you care so much about other people's poetry. Time would pool in corners abominably. I mean the things they say, and I mean the things other people say about other people's poetry. I am now so old. Most of what I read doesn't interest me. The whole world is so prosaic. Do you believe in omens? Of one thing I am absolutely positive. There are certain things we cannot know. One day the shadows will take over the house, and I will ask you once and for all to join me in this firmament. I do not want to see myself in another's image. Whose particularities become a symbol. I could not see past my own voice, which will one day be still.
Amazing poem there from Emily Berry. And the bird song in the background was such gorgeous ambient noise colour. A
little bit of Kentish town, probably. Beautiful. Open window.
If I was my dad, I'd be able to identify those birds, but I'm not.
The incredible, uncanny sort of sleight of hand that Emily Berry has, like that a family could be shocking and then suddenly you are shocked by the idea of a family, something utterly like normal, and the way that she sort of denormalizes in with like a kind of casualness. It's just this, the lawn like a sheet, which on the first kind of like instance feels like, oh, that's a kind of like regular image. But it's kind of like laid down or unfurled by the rockery. And I don't know, it's just like, it's an effortless strangeness that she somehow, children in their little shed in their business. Like they're kind of, like, I don't know, it's like a...
It's like nothing's wrong, but everything's kind of wrong, the way that she's telling it. And the family shocking line, I love it so much because I feel like there is a kind of like... gentle way in which Emily like disrupts the normative, not in a way that feels like sort of dogmatic or something, but just in a way that's like, look how silly the usual is or the normative is. And it like that line always reminds me of when I'd go to the doctor, or if you go to a doctor and they have like a picture of their kid on their desk and you're like, it's always made me feel really like weird and alienated and like shocked at the like concept of like family, like the hierarchy of familial bonds. That's what she does. She like destables like the hierarchies of things in her poems, but all through this kind of like sinister tickly kind of uncanniness.
Yeah. And there's the, I mean, like there's so many sort of rich things in that that she, like she's always been a really good poet of like inference and tension. And it's like kind of being in one of her poems, and it does feel like you're in one of her poems. You don't feel like you're kind of like in, you've been dropped in. It's like, you know, when you're like out and it, the vibe is just, it's not bad, but it's like a bit off. Like everyone's sort of like lurching towards laughter and people keep mishearing or misunderstanding, or like people are too, are like guarded or worried that some offense is about to take place, even though some that nothing offensive is actually being said.
Yeah.
They're just like the vibe is off.
It does feel like a kind of hallucinogenic conversation. And I think particularly with those poems in Unexhausted Time, there's like a stylistic disintegration that she kind of deploys to sort of, I don't know, cover you in this like sort of miasmic cloud of like uncertainty, but in a way that makes you feel like you're being lulled towards certainty. Yeah. It is hallucinogenic, actually. Like it's cerebrally hallucinogenic.
There's things like N being a sad letter and like she's like, suddenly it is. That's the kind of the sort of, I think there's a kind of wisdom in this book.
No, there's power play in her.
Yeah. Yeah.
Poems, for sure.
What about the film, Le Jeté, was it? The Jump?
I've not seen that.
Me neither. Got nothing to say about
it. No, but I do like it when I hear things like that, because then I can add it to my watch list because it's been recommended to me via a poem list.
Yeah. I don't have one of those.
Well, now's your chance. Now my chance. Stop.
I'm going to, yeah.
Amazing poem, an incredible collection.
And to end the episode, we have an audio postcard from Anthony Joseph from Sonnets for Albert, his T.S. Eliot Prize-winning collection published by Bloomsbury.
My name is Anthony Joseph, and I'm currently in Southeast London, Camberwell to be exact. I'm going to read a poem from my latest collection, Sonnets for Albert. I'm going to read a poem called A Gap in Language. A Gap in Language. They are captured forever in monochrome on the leaning lawn of their wedding day in September 1966, before my grandmother dug up the ground to plant flowers. She sewed the dress my mother wore. But who sews a wedding dress? Press a footing on a wasp waste machine. I am also in the image. I am a gap in language, silent until November. But by then they had already begun to drift apart. My father told me how 23 years later, my mother arrived at the board house he was building on squat land in Chaguanas. He thought was to reminisce, but was to serve him divorce papers on a Sunday afternoon. I can imagine them together there, but only as myth, sitting in his unfinished house. I came to know them apart, and I cannot bring them together in death.
That was the Faber Poetry Podcast, presented by Rachel Allen and Jack Underwood and produced by Hannah Marshall, Jack Underwood and Rachel Allen for Faber and Faber.
You can listen to our podcast on your favourite audio platform. And don't forget to subscribe, rate, and tell your friends about our show.